Okay. Once again, good afternoon. My name is Albert Pless, and on behalf of the Black Caucus Health Workers, we want to welcome you to our session 4401, a qualitative assessment of the barbershop model for health promotion of health of African American men, to the oral presentation. So the presenters are all for one project, and so they're going to take pieces of the project and present to us. And so we'll have them all present the project, and then we'll have questions at the end. Okay? All right. So we're going to have, first up is Nataka. Okay. Nataka Moore. So why don't you come on up, actually.
Okay. Hello. Welcome, everybody. Welcome.
Hello.
How are you? I recognize a lot of faces in here, nice, and some new faces. So happy to talk to you about our project. So to get started, as many of you I'm sure already know, African American men suffer disproportionately from a number of health problems compared to their Caucasian counterparts. The leading cause of death amongst African American men over the age of 18 in 2010 included heart disease, cancer, unintentional injuries, and stroke. Research shows that heart disease rates are more than 40% higher, which is a real problem. Death rate for all cancers is 30% higher in African American men, and HIV/AIDS death rate is more than 7 times that for whites. So disparities among African American men may be due to a complex interplay of factors within the individual, interpersonal, community, and macro systems. And one of the things also that we know is that there, you know, for African American men, oftentimes there's the issue of where to go to get culturally relevant services. And so we know from history that oftentimes there's a mistrust of the medical field, and so therefore it makes it difficult for people to get, for black men to get their needs met in that space. As a result, the barbershop model was developed. So the black church and barbershops have served as an important role when communicating health information over the last 15 years especially. Trained barbers have been used to promote and screen for prostate and colon cancer, improve blood pressure control for hypertensive black men, collect health screenings, HIV, and obtain fecal occult blood tests. Project Brotherhood has been instrumental in being a part of this. We'll talk about them a little bit later. The Center for Minority Health at the University of Pittsburgh School of Public Health trained barbers and stylists to deliver health and wellness messages. So although the research have shown barbershops to be effective, it doesn't talk about who's being served. So a couple of years at APHA, I was, I forgot where it was at a couple of years ago. Where was it? Two years ago. Boston. It was in Boston, actually. And I was listening to a panel talk about, you know, the barbershop model, and I realized that when talking about finding culturally relevant spaces for African-American men, oftentimes the barbershop model comes up. And I realized, well, my father doesn't go to church regularly, and he doesn't go to the barber. So where would you find men like my father? Where would you find him? And so I started talking to some of the presenters, and they said, you know, you're right. We, you know, what about those men who don't fall in those spaces? So when I went back to Chicago, I decided to do a literature review to look through all the barbershop models to see if they really captured who's being captured or who goes to the barbers and who doesn't get their hair cut or who doesn't necessarily attend church regularly, so we can figure out who the barbershop model will work appropriately for. So we needed to understand the strengths and limitations of the model because we were applying too much to the barbershop model. Everything was, if you want to reach black men, go to church or the barbershop, but then there may be a group of men you can't reach in that way. So we need to begin to think outside the box and come up with other solutions for men who may not be at those locations. But even so, with the men that we can find at the barbershop, what is their demographics? What about them? So then we can, you know, specialize in the type of programming we're running to make sure it's more effective. In addition, African-American male life expectancy is 10 years less than the national average, which is a real problem. Therefore, developing culturally and demographically relevant interventions toward improving black men's health is imperative. So the goals of our current study that we did was we wanted to, once again, investigate the demographics of African-American men who most frequent African-American serving barbershops across Chicago and assess who's not represented at these barbershops. Determine if the barbershop is appropriate to address mental health concerns, because here's the thing, I'm a psychologist, and when I looked across all of the literature, there wasn't anything done, there wasn't any education in any of the barbershops around mental health. And in Chicago, this is particularly important as many of the mental health clinics in Chicago has closed, and recently, if you don't know, they just recently closed C4, which is going to impact 10,000 Chicagoans. So this is really important in looking at other ways of increasing mental health education and screening, particularly on the south sides and west sides of Chicago. We wanted to determine if barbers felt capable of influencing client health decision. So we assume that the barbers feel comfortable being able to provide these intervention techniques for a range of men, and we wanted to see what their thoughts were on this particular issue. And we wanted to generate ideas for other avenues for outreach for African-American men who do not regularly go to the barbershop. So we also included in our questionnaire, where can you find men ages, for instance, 30 to 39, that is not going to church and that's not in a barbershop? Where can you find men 40 to 49 that's not in church, that's not going to barbershop? We wanted to hear from the men themselves, where could we find these men? What are the other culturally relevant and safe spaces to find these men?
My name is Jessica Gibson. I was one of the research assistants with Dr. Moore on this project. So before we began our research, we decided to partner up with Project Brotherhood. And if Mr. Murray would like to stand away, he was instrumental in our partnership with Project Brotherhood because he actually helped us find a lot of the barbershops that we ended up going to. So I don't know if you stayed for the last session. I don't know if you mentioned it, but you know, Project Brotherhood is a non-for-profit agency. Began in the 90s. Excuse me. They have a team of health professionals and non-professionals working together to aid the needs of males. So they have a medical clinic, they have social services, they have fatherhood and manhood development classes and workshops. They do meditations, and weekly they have free haircuts and a mentoring program. So with these free haircuts, they keep these people coming back every week with a free haircut, and they keep them interested with free haircut and get them to go to the clinics and get them to get screened. And, you know, they have found, you know, cancers and all this stuff. So this partnership was really instrumental because they're already working in the community doing good things. Excuse me. So for our methods, we had a total of 127 participants, 104 patrons, and 23 barbers. And we went to 25 barber shops in 14 of the neighborhoods of Chicago. So to find these barbershops, we used the 2010 Chicago area census data, and we evaluated the percentage of African Americans in each of the 77 neighborhoods on the south and the west side, because we know that these are areas where mostly predominantly African Americans live. So we then selected 30 areas with 40% or higher of African American males. So we Googled barbershops in Chicago, Illinois. And then we, the research assistants, called all these barbershops and explained what we were trying to do with our research. And we established up to 25 barbershops that would allow us to come in. We came in on Fridays and Saturdays because we know those are the busiest days for barbershops, because those were guys, you know, getting their haircut for the weekend. Excuse me. So Once we received permission from the owner or the head barber, we went in, we talked to at least one barber, and we've tried to get 3 to 5 patrons to participate in the study as well. So we provided each patron with a $10 reimbursement for their time, and each barber $15 reimbursement for their time, because we figured that was the amount of money they were missing out with that time spent filling out each questionnaire. So we all developed the questionnaire ourselves. We all talked about what are the things we're going to be looking for. We want to look at, you know, demographics, socioeconomic status. We'd use free response questions and multiple choice questions. We looked at the attitudes regarding receiving medical and mental health screening, and education in barbershops were assessed in a multiple choice questionnaire format. So the barbers completed an additional 8-question survey regarding the age of clients that they most felt that they most often and least often serve, and the age of clients whose decision making they feel that they could influence the most. We're going to get into the results later on. So for demographics, we wanted to point out that there's about 97.6% of heterosexuals, people who identified as heterosexual. So when we're thinking about these things and the interventions that we're using for this population, we have to remember that we're reaching people who identify as heterosexual. So we're only reaching a percentage of the population. There are people who identify as gay, bisexual, transgender, and so we have to be able to reach everyone. And also, within this type of a situation, not every man is going to identify as heterosexual or bisexual if they don't feel comfortable in a room full of other men. So these actually might not be accurate if they didn't feel comfortable identifying in that moment. One thing we did leave out, we didn't really focus on comprehension and understanding. We noticed as we were giving some of these questionnaires and surveys that some men needed more help understanding these questions, and so we'd have to explain them further. And so that's another thing we have to keep in mind when we're, you know, trying to do public health awareness. Giving these pamphlets out all the time doesn't really, you know, impact everyone if they're not understanding what the words really mean. Okay? So another point, most of the men live within 5 miles of the barbershop, as you can see, 67.5%. So we're only reaching the people within that little bubble. So we have to make sure that we are able to reach, you know, as wide as we can. Another point we wanted to make, we use the 30,000 and under percentage, I mean, 1,000-year income as our poverty screening, but we didn't really look at how many people were actually in the home, so we don't know the actual poverty levels of the people who we were talking to. So one thing we found that was interesting after doing this survey, that this distribution is similar to the age trend for African-American men in Chicago. So every barber and client, it basically emulates the same curve for the Chicago trend of men. And the men in the barbershop actually are reflecting the ages of men in Chicago as a whole.
Okay. Hi, everyone. I'm Greg Jordan, and I was another one of the research assistants on this study. And I'm going to be talking about our statistical comparisons between the 2010 census data and our actual study. So this is pretty much showing So this is just showing our comparisons between the 2010 census data and the data that we found in our study. And as you can see, for the barbershop participants, 91% had insurance, where on average from the census data, 82% had insurance. High school graduates were 96.8%, whereas from the census data, 79% were high school graduates. And with income, as Jessica said, we made our own income level cutoff for poverty, and this isn't reflective of the national average, but 40% of the participants made less than $30,000 a year, whereas the national average was 28.2%. And the unemployment rate was 21%, while the unemployment rate, the average between the neighborhoods and the census data was 25%. And as I said, this percentage includes all races in the neighborhoods. And on average, Chicago African Americans have a 34.5% poverty rate. All right, and this slide is talking about their attitudes toward the healthcare systems. So as you can see, for physical health screenings in a medical health center or from a medical health professional, 90.5% of the men said that they had received health education or screening in the past year. 89.8% said that they felt comfortable at a medical doctor's office. 12.6% said they felt safe at a they felt they received health training at a church event, and they felt comfortable. And 11.8% said they felt comfortable at a barbershop via trained barbers. And I just like to compare this to the mental health screening. Although only 13.5% said they had had mental health screening in the last year, 9.5% said they would feel comfortable at a barbershop. And comparing this to receiving healthcare information at a barbershop and mental healthcare information at a barbershop is almost equal. So this may be a good thing to look into for as far as reaching African American men with mental health information and mental health care. And then this is also talking about their attitude towards the healthcare system. And it says of the participants, a lot of them endorsed that the experience of a clinician was the main reason for their preference towards receiving health services in a doctor's office. And with the survey, we said since men could mark none or all the answers for this question, the percentages reported in the bar graph are the percentage of responses for where are you comfortable receiving mental health or health education screening. And I think that's all.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Matera, and I attend Adler University, and I was also one of the research assistants with this project. So, as we discussed earlier, there were questionnaires given both to the patrons as well as the barbers as a part of this study. And so the patrons had a separate questionnaire from what the barbers had. The barbers had 8 additional questions. I'm going to focus on 3 particular questions that are relevant to this particular presentation. The first question was the age of your most frequent customers. So the barbers were to respond to basically the 2 most frequent age groups that they saw as their clientele. So that the age range was from 18 to 29, 30 to 39, 40 to 49, 50 to 64, and 65 and up. And then at the same time, on the flip side of the coin, we also wanted to know the age of their least frequent customers. So who were they serving the least amount of the time? So ages 18 to 29, 30 to 39, 40 to 49, 50 to 64, and age 65 and up. The third question was, do you feel you can influence the decisions of African American men based on different age groups? And they were supposed to respond either yes or no. So ages 18 to 29 years old, do they feel like they can influence their decision making? Yes or no? 30 to 39, 40 to 49, 50 to 64, and then of course 65 and up. So based on the barber's questionnaire, these were their results. Barbers, the average amount of clients that each barber saw per week was about 20 clients. And so of the barbers that responded, 76.2% of the barbers listed the age range of 30 to 39 in the top 2 most commonly served age groups. The other most commonly served age group was 18 to 29, with 66.7% of the barbers identifying that age range as their most commonly served age group. On the flip side, the 2 least served age groups were 65 and up and 50 to 64, with 65 and up being 66.7% of the barber's response, and then 50 to 64 being 50% of the barber's responses. So, looking more at the barber's questionnaire, 13.6% of the barbers had decision-making influence on clients over the age of 40. So this was their perception and their opinion. So 13.6% 13.6, only 13.6% of the barbers felt like they could actually influence their clients who were age 40 and up. 95.5% felt that they had influence on clients ages 18 to 29. So based on what the barbers were saying was that they felt they had more of an influence, or they could influence decision-making of their younger clientele as opposed to the clientele who were over the age of 40. And so when we break that down further, based on the percentage of barbers and how comfortable they felt actually engaging in health discussions, looking at the different age groups, 30.6% of the barbers felt they were comfortable with talking to 18 to 29-year-olds. 33.3%, so that's about one-third, thought that they were most comfortable talking to 30 to 39-year-olds. 19% felt comfortable discussing health issues with 40 to 49-year-olds. 11% felt comfortable talking to 50 to 64-year-olds, and only 5% felt comfortable talking to clients ages 65 and up about health concerns. So thinking about this, looking at how comfortable the barbers are actually talking to the clientele, their clientele, and also who they see most frequently, we have a concern here, right? So there's different health issues based on age range, particularly with physical health, right? So for individuals over the age of 50, that opens a completely different can of worms and separate set of health issues in addition to the ones you see in the younger population as well. So things like prostate cancer, right? So prostate cancer would affect clients ages 50 and up, especially African-American males. However, we have to look at if the barbers don't feel comfortable talking about health information to this age group, and then they're also not servicing as many clientele in this age group, are they actually getting the information? And if they are getting the information, the barbers are not comfortable talking about this information. So how can we address that? So by looking here at the chart, this is basically similar to what I just stated. You can actually see the trend. So you can see who the barbers believe they can influence the most. So you see the rise from ages 18 to 39, and then you see the steady decline after the age of 39. So you see the decline with 40 to 49. There's another drop-off between 50 and 64. And then, of course, the smallest amount of comfort with talking to individuals who are 65 years and older. So based on these findings, what's next, right? What do we do with this information? So we think we should investigate ways to approach mental health using the barbershop model. So even though we saw that only 11% of the clientele stated that they felt comfortable getting physical health information at the barbershop, and then only 9% for mental health, the physical health, even though clientele are saying they don't feel comfortable, has been shown to work in previous research. So even if they're not endorsing that they're comfortable, it's working. The method works. So can we do the same thing with mental health? We would think so, since there's not a huge difference between their comfort and the physical and the mental health. So our next publication actually will be to find where African American men will go. Like, where can we find these groups of African American men who were not actually at the barbershop or at church? So we have the data. I do want to make that statement, but we're in the process of writing that paper right now. Okay. We also want to look at ways to approach mental health as far as using the barbershop model. So can we use pamphlets? Do we need to bring mental health practitioners into the barbershop? Can we train barbers to be able to disseminate mental health screener information and then give clients more information to refer out to different mental health practitioners and counselors? The next thing we want to look at is, what are interventions for older African American men that may be better approached elsewhere or by highly trained barbers? So the barbers are saying they're not comfortable talking to individuals over the age of 40, or not as comfortable talking to individuals over the age of 40, about health information. So what do we need to do to be able to reach these age groups? Next, we want to look at efforts to improve clinician and patient relations among African Americans. This is critical, right? So we see the research that says if a relationship or rapport can be established between the professional and the client or the consumer, you're more likely to actually absorb the information that you hear. You're also more likely to follow up on your appointments, right? So we need to figure out what is it that we can do to increase trust in the African-American community for medical and mental health services and practitioners, and then how can we build those relationships? So a community academic approach may be needed. So actually going into the communities where people feel safe and are willing to talk about different issues as opposed to, no, you come to me as the professional. So I just want to have a few acknowledgments. The first is for the Chicago Global Health Alliance. We want to thank them for all their support and assistance. The funding was provided by a grant at Adler University, Northwestern Department of Urology, Project Brotherhood, definitely, for serving as our consultant and helping us to see how we're wording the questionnaires, also preparing us on how to act or how to present at a barbershop, because as an African-American woman, it's not quite the same as walking into the beauty salon. And then also we just want to make sure to thank all of the barbershop owners, the managers, the clients, and the barbers who participated and were open to allowing us into their space. And I also would like to call Marcus Murray up if you would like to come say a few words.
I think Mr. Weeks is going to ask questions.
Just a brief history of Project Brotherhood with the barbershops. A lot of people ask. Let me just tell a story. In 97, when we had the focus groups, I was actually a participant in the focus groups. A buddy of mine was a real-life actual barber, so it's not complicated. We participated in the groups. Some individuals said, we're going to start this program for black men. The barber said, okay, if you start this program, I offer free haircuts. If men look better, they'll feel better. So that's how we started incorporating barbers into Project Brotherhood. One day I was sitting in a barber shop. When I had hair, I used to have braids, and I really had nice long hair. No way happened. But I was sitting in a barber shop, and there was a 60-year-old man in the barber shop, I assume 60 to 65, and there were some little kids in there, 7 to 10 years old. And if you've ever been in a barber shop, it's heavy testosterone. It's men. And we really add an extra sense of testosterone to everything we say and doing. So the older gentleman said, I've never caught a STI. He didn't use that. I'm being politically correct. I never got burnt because I urinate after I have sex. So I'm sitting there thinking, like, first of all, you're lucky, you know. But I'm sitting there thinking, like, the influence that barbers have on society, and in that shop, the red, white, and blue pole, barbers were actually surgeons back in the day. But for the black community, barbers are like, the best way I could put it, are like ghetto preachers. That's who we go to. If you don't go to church, or even if you do go to church, you come to the barbershop because they know everything, the information. People come in selling things. So I said, what can we do? I got these young brothers in here thinking, if they engage in sex without a condom and urinate after they have sex, that they won't catch an STI, they won't impregnate a woman, they won't catch HIV. This is crazy. I said, but I can't argue with this elder in my community. You know, we respect our elders. We need to respect them more, but we respect them. So we came up with the concept. Who do people listen to when they go to the shop? The people that make them look better, the barbers. So we started training barbers on basic things like HIV and other health things. And then we've never published for a variety of reasons, and then it just took off. So every time people wanted to reach black men, they said, let's go to the barbershop. But we know as black men that that's not the only place you can go to talk to black men. But in the data, everybody, the barbershop, just like the church. So what we wanted to do, and I want to say Dr. Moore, when she came with the concept and her students, just the energy that they brought and the excitement to go in these shops was incredible. We just served as like a catalyst. This is what we do. How can we help you? They really took over. I deliberately stepped back and said, okay, I want to watch you do it. The best way to learn how to engage with the community is to sometimes fall down. There was another colleague of ours. He was a Caucasian guy from Indiana. And when we said we're going all over Chicago, the West Side, 47th Street, 71st Street, 95th Street. After about 2-3 times going, even the people started to respect him and understand him. But without these young people going there and talking to the men, at first, you know, they were being professional before they actually went there. They would say, excuse me, we were practicing. I said, come on now, you got to talk to men where they are and how they're doing and approach it like that. They did an excellent job. To get to men to engage in any type of setting is incredible. So what they did in looking at the research, and if you could go back, not go back, if you remember what they said, I think it was 80% of black men said they want to get health information from a doctor. Well, that's all they know. What was the second was the church, and right behind it was the barbershop. So we understand black men don't go to church all the time. Black men don't go to the doctor. So what's the key point of providing healthcare information to black men? It starts at the barbershop. Once you go to the barbershop and all the people in that neighborhood are within that 5 miles of that barbershop, the people in that shop and the people in that neighborhood become the key stakeholders to tell you where to go. So if they tell us, and when we go back and we do further things, if they say, hey, you need to hit the liquor store right around the corner. You need to hit this parking lot where some of the men just sit out and hang. Those are the men we want to reach. Those are the men that we're going to go after. Also, people that go to barbershops, most of the times, are employed. Because barbers, haircuts cost $15 to $20. So we'll be missing out on the brothers that aren't employed or underemployed, that have dreadlocks, that cut their own hair. So the research that we're about to embark on is crucial because we don't want to change the dynamics of research with black men and say, don't utilize the barbershops. We want you to understand, utilize the barbershops, but think outside the box. Go to where black men are. Ask the men where to go. And some of their answers were amazing. And some of the things the young ladies and Greg did were amazing. You know, these two young ladies are psychologists, or were trying to be psychologists. Psychologist, and Greg's a first-year medical student. So our goal of Project Brotherhood, along with Dr. Moore and other people to help out, was to bring young people, get them involved in research, get them out the academic institution. These young ladies were coming out on Saturdays. They were coming after work, because when do men get their haircuts? They don't get it in the middle of the day, because they're usually working. So the academic and community partner relationship between us two individuals allow for these students to go out there and do some amazing work.
Is there anything else I need to say?
I don't want to take over anything, but thank you.
That's great. Thank you.
Okay, so we have a lot of time for some questions, and so we're going to take them. And so you can speak to a few things. And once again, I think you can speak to the project. You can even there's folks in the room. I know that a lot of work around this too. So let's just figure out where you direct your question to. But feel free to ask your questions to multiple folks. Go ahead, yes.
Absolutely. So the average age of the barber was between 30 and 39. So because that was the average age across all the barbershops, they just in general did not feel comfortable with older. So it was based on their age. So even if we found older barbers, they probably would follow that progression that the older they are, the more comfortable they are with people their age and younger. And so that's what we found, and that's the issue. And so for things like we said with prostate cancer, things of that nature that might impact men a little bit older and bringing it in there, then we need to think about them, what that means and how we train our barbers to be comfortable to work with men who may be older than them. And so to consider that in the intervention, whatever program that you're developing. But great question. Thank you.
You can stay up because I'm...
Oh, it's for me?
You know, I'm a fan of your work. And I'm wondering if you had considered this next iteration utilizing community health as a model as well.
Yes.
In terms of the reason I like this idea is because it also drives economic development. So men that may be frequent visitors of the barbershop would also be an opportunity for some workforce development for themselves. And then you could also possibly address that navigation. So,
I love that, and that's why we're going to have you as a part of the team when we talk about the next phase.
And we want to work with Dr. Connors Boyd and community health workers have been next to
it. Let's make that happen. Absolutely.
Okay.
Can you talk about how we train the regular barber versus how you train? Are you referring to age when you say how you train? Are you referring to the training that Marcus referred to of how the early barbers were trained?
Okay, so just to be sure I'm understanding, you're saying highly trained.
On one of your slides, you said that one of your next interventions or proposed interventions might be to introduce highly trained barbers. Yeah. I don't know how you define highly trained.
Okay, so right, to train them in possible mental health techniques, you know, so they would have to be trained.
Okay, so mm-hmm. What's related to the age, the fact that as age goes up, that it comes
back? Right, no, we would have to train them. Mm-hmm. Okay, yes, and I want some of my students to answer so they can get a chance.
Okay.
So, just coming from a background, my husband is a salon owner and a barber by trade. So, this area of interest, you know, kind of jumped out at me, particularly because for the work that I do with teens and pregnancy prevention, I use his salon for a kind of connection. So, just using salons as a point of distribution for anybody.
Answer that. Okay, great question. So the two things that we know is, one, that the men stated that the only reason why they feel more comfortable going to a medical office or a psychologist office is because the clinician there is the expert. But it's not necessarily about the setting, it's more the person. So one thing we know for sure is maybe it might work then, do we bring those folks to the community, which we talked about. That's one option. Two, the other option is, do we train the barbers to also be able to better do some basic level education and screening? And so we don't know yet. So our next phase actually now when looking at mental health is bringing in barbers, bringing in people who go to the barbershop to identify what are some of the top issues. Would you be more open to this or that, and doing focus groups? Because we want to develop it with folks constantly. Every part of what we do, we know that we have to expand outside of ourselves to then bring it back to the community to see would this possibly be effective. So that's actually our next phase, is doing focus groups, really drilling down to that very question to figure out how do we develop the model. Awesome.
That's great. Yeah.
Awesome.
He has a lot of connection, and what you guys said was very salient to what he does. And he's very comfortable talking to all age groups, and he's set up health information groups, health screening days, and things of that nature. And maybe he has some insight on how to do
that. That would be great. So afterwards, maybe we can get your information.
Yeah, he'll
Thank you. Okay. Thank you. Okay, Matera, you're up.
Well, it was a questionnaire, so we didn't actually control for things as far as that's concerned. We did have questions on the questionnaire that did ask about marital status. However, as far as like when we asked, oh, have you gone and had a health screening, a physical health screening in the past year, or a mental health screening in the past year, we didn't ask the question, well, who initiated the health screening? So I do think that would be something to look at in the future, but we didn't do that for this particular part of the study.
And we could say that we found that most of them were not married, which also is a...
I have sort of a follow-up question to that. In terms of that 90%, that seems high to me. How does that compare to sort of the national average for
I don't have the exact numbers as far as African American men that go see the doctor on average, but I mean, from what we saw in the data and what we thought, like our the group that we interviewed had a lot higher rates of going to the doctor overall. And for the second part of your question,
how they deal with, do they think it's Dr. Botswick, yes, those are really good questions, and we did have that conversation too. So it wasn't necessarily they went to a medical doctor where they had something, received some information, some screening, something of that nature. And we did think, oh wow, 90% is great if it's accurate, but it is a little bit higher than what we expected. And so that's something we're looking at to see what actually is the number, and comparing it once again to not necessarily going to the medical office, but receiving some sort of information in the past year. Absolutely, with some of this, it could be some sampling bias, but then we also have to look at the mental health, and it was at 13%. So they didn't endorse that extremely high. So not really for sure what to do with that, but that's something that we're constantly thinking about, is possible, you know, marking certain things to for a certain reason, but they did not endorse that for mental health.
But we wouldn't expect them to necessarily give
given the stigma of it. Yeah, that's true. That's true. So something to think about, absolutely.
My question is that there's a lot of stigma associated with mental health, especially within the African American community. And you guys mentioned that being tackling that on the next phase. How do you guys plan to address that issue or that stigma that's around mental health and mental health issues?
Okay, so that's one of the things we will focus on when we do our focus groups. But I mean, what we were speaking about towards the end of the presentation, the academic plus community merge, basically. We want to partner with places like Project Brotherhood or any other place already in the community, so it's less of an us versus them, the outsider coming to tell us what to do with our health, and it's more of a partnership rather than, you know, get your health together. And by partnering with these people and places like Project Brotherhood, they will help us maintain our cultural relevance, our appropriateness when we are trying to tackle these things in the future, like stigma and things like
that.
Like I said, all praise, we all got issues. Just everybody, not just black men.
that's very interesting because our experience was much different from the other research team. So Matera and I went out with Mr. Murray and Dr. Murphy, and Greg and the other researcher, Daniel, went out with Dr. Moore. And Mr. Murray sometimes, too. So we found that me and Matera had a lot more an ease getting people to participate. I can assume, young, I don't want to, sound arrogant, or semi-attractive women coming in and smiling at these guys like, hey, you want to participate in our study? And we're smiling, you're engaging. And then, see some guys walk in, medical people, all professional. And so I think that played a really big difference, for the interest. Definitely, because if we were sitting next to them, they might have not, put specific things down. Like Dr. Murphy, I don't know where he went. Dr. Murphy was saying one of the guys that he was sitting next to, he noticed that if he walked away, then he was, a little more apt to be like, oh, okay, I'm bisexual. But, if we're sitting right next to them and they're, bisexual, they're homosexual, we don't know. Because, they think someone's watching them. They're in a room full of other men, testosterone's flowing. They want to be in a married, wife, blah, 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 blah. I make this much money. We don't know what, they're really wanting to say if we're hovering over them. So, yeah, that played a part. Yeah, so we didn't hover. We would give it to them sometimes, or we'd walk away. And if they needed help, then we would, sit next to them and go over the questions with them. We did not focus on that, what was your experience in the barbershops?
I mean, overall, I felt like it ranged. Some barbershops we went to, the men were in and out. They were really good with appointments, and other ones, it would be hours. Like, I remember one me and Daniel went to, we were probably there for, 2 or 3 hours just because, it would take so long for, people to get their hair cut, then people would take a while coming in. So I feel like it just really varies depending on, I guess, how well the barber is with, holding up appointments and, keeping a close schedule. So.
Also, just to speak to that, something that I observed, even though it wasn't formally assessed as far as with the questionnaire, is sometimes people, they get their haircut and they just sit there and chill. You go for the conversation sometimes, right? So if they're still sitting there just talking, they're in the barbershop for a longer period of time, but they're not actually getting a haircut, right? Mm-hmm.
It's a safe haven.
Yeah, a lot of guys that go to the barbershop, they're not even there to get their hair cut. They're just there to socialize, talk about the game and stuff like that. So,
which is part of the original part of the theory as far as why the barbershop model actually works.
Yeah.
was going to just build on that question. So 2 points. One is how, because you're a first year medical student. Yeah. So I'm just thinking about how can we work better on training the providers to be a lot more culturally competent, and really, because it seems like it's an opportunity there to help train these physicians to actually go in these communities and really be a lot more, a lot more of a connection here. So just that, it's a comment really. But how do you think that if we incentivize the barbers, would that increase? Do we think that would increase their the ability for them to reach more participants for this? Like, you know, in terms of really having more of a stipend, you know, would that help?
I'm curious, Marcus, to your thoughts on
that. Yeah, what do you think? It's not just but really just really incentivize them.
Actually, it's similar. The only way to do work in the community. People can't come to us, all of us in this room on our job, and say, I need you to do some more as our job description. So if I'm going to a bar and I want to work with him, and remember, we're getting paid, we're doing grants, we're doing research, even though we like our tasks and all that, I can't ask him to take on another task without making sure he receives some incentive. If I'm coming to somebody's house for Thanksgiving, I'm going to bring my plate. I'm coming to your shop, I'm going to disrupt the flow. We just have to remember, some clients might not want us there. Some clients might not want to, I want to get no health stuff. I can't really talk about the day. So we have to make it more comfortable for the barber by paying the barber and paying the participants. And it's not coercion, it's an IIP. What's going to happen is the brothers and sisters in the hood understand research. They have cousins and aunts and family members that work for these universities. They're tired of us coming in the hood, not caring for their time, and then leaving the hood. So unless we change the way we think about IIB research and the importance of the community, regardless of the community, then all of us are going to have jobs.
Yes. Yes.
Issues at Atler. Yeah, but Atler also is, you know, their mission is to do some of that work, and, you know, and they're looking for more faculty to do that work. So Kareem, maybe you can speak on that a little bit, because we didn't have issues, but Kareem, maybe you can speak on that.
We have some CDPR stuff.
right? So instead of, you know, right. So you're saying instead of or in addition to the hospital?
In addition to,
exactly. Mm-hmm. It has to be a food in the hospital, so in addition to. Limitations of maybe understanding maybe the way the questions were, or just had some questions, so they may call us over to them to just make sure they understood what the question meant, but they were all anonymous.
It's a good discussion, and I think it's taken us, you know, to different places. Any other questions that folks have? Okay. All right. So we want to thank our panelists for...